Good morning. Can you hear me? Am I on? One, two? Yes, now I'm on. So I discovered this morning that if I want to win a Macintosh notebook at one of these conferences, it's going to be quite difficult for me. Basically, if I want to win it, I'm going to have a sex change or something, because at the server-side Java Symposium, there were exactly three female participants of about 500, and one of them won the Macintosh notebook for early registration. At this conference, we're about 250 and about five ladies, and again, one of them won the Macintosh notebook. So basically, for us guys, there's not much chance, but if you've got a lady friend who needs a notebook, just bring it along to the next TSS Java Symposium and she'll have a notebook. Right, I'm going to talk about a subject that is a bit different to what we've spoken to up to now. It's basically about, the question is, what do you do when you get pulled into a project where the previous developer either was fired because of his ineptitude, or he left because he was so brilliant, or he died or something? What do you do when you're sitting with a whole lot of code which is impossible to work with? How do you go about it? And when I was preparing the talk, I phoned my father-in-law, who used to be a professional soccer player, and seeing that we've got the soccer happening in Europe at the moment, it's maybe appropriate. And I asked him, would you have played soccer if you hadn't been paid for it? And his answer was, of course. And so the question is for us, would we code if we weren't being paid to code? And I think for a lot of us, the answer will be yes. And so it's about coding for a passion, not just coding as a job. So what I want to talk about is some little tips on how to make it easier working with the machine. Some of the things were discussed this morning, actually. And also how to make the computer less frustrated with having you around. Just a bit of background. Those of you who haven't heard of this, I write a newsletter which has a very arrogant title called the Java Specialists Newsletter. It doesn't mean that I know much about Java, it just means that that's all I know about. I've got 20,000 readers in 112 countries. I've now added Gibraltar, which the way I decide if it's a country or not is a bit different. Basically, if it's got a domain extension, then it's a country, which sorts out all the political discussions of whether Catalan is an independent country or not. If it doesn't have a domain extension, it's not. So I actually have a newsletter translated into Catalan. Now, I also teach Java all around the world. Most of the time it's in-house, so I go into companies and train developers. I'm a Java champion. We discussed that on Wednesday night, what it means. And I've worked on several large systems. And it's not just coding. I've done a lot of coding. I've written thousands of bugs. But also going into systems and analyzing them, having a look at what has actually been written. The most recent one was a 2.5 million line monster. Now, once you get to that size, it starts getting really difficult detecting copy and paste code. This is my website, my newsletter website. Just want to show you what it sort of looks like when you go to the internet. If you see that, that's me. All right, now, the typical programmer works about 60 hours per week behind the computer screen. Now, I know that in Europe, it's not supposed to be like that. You're supposed to work about, was it 28, 35? Somewhere around there. But because we are all very dedicated, we all spend time working more. And so what we want to do is we try and reduce the hours by becoming more effective. So any gain we can get by becoming more effective is going to help us to spend less time having to do boring, mundane work. And so if you think about it, if you're going to be spending a lot of time doing something, you should learn it as well as possible. And the scary thing is I still see a lot of programmers who do the hunt and peck typing. It's just something small, which has nothing to do with Java. But, you know, where's my other? You know, being able to type whilst watching TV is a skill you need to be able to do. Not that you need to code while watching TV, but just being able to have a close knowing where everything is on the keyboard and having and flowing nicely with the machine while you're working with it. Now, I've got a friend in Greece who refuses to use the keyboard because he says that it's an arcane tool, and so he doesn't use a computer basically. But he's right, it is very old, but the human computer in action is not progressing fast enough to improve. I mean, ideally what I would want to do is I would like to lie on the couch and say, write a class for me with the following attributes, boom, 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 and the class is done. But I think that's not 2010, that's going to be 2020 or 30 maybe. So, you know, this type of thing, the absolute basics, is really something which every programmer should have spent doing. Something which I noticed about European keyboards, I've spent some time working in France and working in Germany, is that all the keys are in the wrong place for coding. Take the semicolon, for example. If you're coding in American, the semicolon's a little thing on the right-hand side. If you do it in Germany, it's some weird shift, comma or dot combination. So what I normally do is I switch it to American and then just touch type. It's again why you need to know how to touch type. It's the absolute basics, and it applies to any language, not just Java. In fact, with Ruby, it's probably more important. And if you combine that with the Java IDEs, you become even more productive. Your whole approach goes better. So then you get to the next step, which is not just knowing your keyboard, but knowing your keyboard shortcuts. And what I do is when I use a new IDE, I take the IDE and I memorize the keyboard shortcuts, as many as I can. And I start using them frequently. And it's incredible how much faster you become when you are working from the keyboard instead of grabbing the mouse every time. Now, I know I'm probably preaching to the choir here, but have a look around you in your organizations. Have a look at your developers, how many of them are using the mouse-driven approach for almost everything. And it's quite scary, because every time you use a mouse, you move away from the keyboard, you have a context switch, you have to go back to the keyboard, it disturbs everything. Now, what makes it a little bit tricky is that the IDEs are different. So if you take, for example, Eclipse, Control-D deletes the line, then IntelliJ, Control-D duplicates the line. So if you're used to duplicating lines, and now you're switching between IDEs, it starts getting a bit tricky. I always like to have some knowledge of tools like VI, because they help for small jobs, and it's also, again, good discipline keyboard use. Now, everybody's got their favorite IDE. I personally prefer IntelliJ, even though Eclipse is becoming very, very close. But I wanted to show you a little demo of how one can do, how I can create a few classes without using the mouse. And I can do the same thing in Eclipse, exactly the same. I'm just going to do it quickly in IntelliJ because I'm a bit more used to that. So what you do is you create a new class called Flower. Okay, you want to... make the font readable. Although I'm not sure if any font is readable unless it's like 200 or something. Let's make this 36 there. Right, flower. So we have inside flower we've got string, common name, string scientific name, int height, and rarity status. Now, of course, we all know that you should never have package access fields, so we make them private. Right? And we need a constructor for these. You know, this is all the magic that you get from just about every IDE, getters and setters. Now, I'm going to talk about getters and setters a bit more just now. You've got your equals and hash code methods, which in this case should depend on your scientific name. Okay? We need to create rarity, which tells us how rare the flower is. And we have an enum for that. We can say common, rare, extinct. And then we make another class. In this class, I can now write a little test program. Fanbus fan. Write the main method. And you now create your flower. And what I'll do is I'll make a flower called a marsh rose, which none of you have seen. I can almost guarantee that. It's a very rare flower in South Africa, which only grows if there's been a fire. And but it only grows if there haven't been too many fires. So it's really weird. It's almost extinct. So this is this marsh rose, Orothumnus zaheri. So we'll just call it marsh rose. I'm not going to go into the details. It gets about 5 meters high. And it is... Wait, I must put a comma there. And it is extremely rare. And then you can do, you know, whatever you want to do with it. Let's print out the marshrose.getScientificName. Okay, now I'm working completely with my fingers. Without the mouse. The mouse is not even being needed at all. Of course, you need it for some things, but most of the time I'm going to try and keep away from it because it's much faster to use a keyboard combination than to use a mouse. I mean, if you look at what I did here with the, I don't know if you noticed that with making these things private, if I did that with the mouse, I would probably go and double-click, delete, double-click, delete, double-click, delete, double-click, delete. And this obviously will slow me down. It's much easier to just do this. All right. So it doesn't matter what IDE you use. It's Eclipse, NetBeans, IntelliJ, Emacs, if you want to. But whatever you do, know it well. Because if you don't know it well, then it becomes, it's going to slow you down. You want to be as fast as possible. Don't use Notepad. That's not a good idea. I gave this talk in South Africa as a practice run to see how it would come across. And one of the people said, what happens when your fingers overtake your brain? In other words, you're refactoring faster and you're changing things faster than you're thinking. Which, of course, means that after you've done all your changes, the code doesn't work anymore. Now, one thing you could do is you could try and slow down speed up your brain. And what helps there is to think as much as possible in higher level concepts, thinking more in terms of design patterns than in terms of just the line of code that you're working with. So that's something which you have to keep in mind, is that you don't want to get to the situation where you're coding so fast that you're coding absolute nonsense. It's like, have you ever tried coding when you've had a couple of beers? Yeah, the next morning, you know, that night you've solved all the problems, and the next morning you look at the code and you say, no, this is absolute nonsense. It doesn't even compile. I used to work for a company where they had a policy of free beers after 5 o'clock. So the guys used to hang around and play solitaire until 5 o'clock and then start working, which was extremely unproductive. I'll show you one of their projects just now. Okay, so design patterns, thinking high-level constructs, this is something which has become completely mainstream. This is not nothing fringe anymore. It's like refactoring. When I first heard about refactoring 5 years ago, I was quite amazed by the idea. Nowadays, it's everybody knows about it. And it gives us the way how to think in object orientation. What it also does is it fixes thinking mistakes. I had a problem 2 years ago when I went to Germany and I was carrying my laptop around. I hurt my back from carrying the laptop because it's just too heavy. when I went to a physiotherapist, he said, well, your hips are skewed. You know, I don't believe that nonsense, but he fixed my hips supposedly, but I haven't had a sore back since then, so I don't know if it's true or not. But in terms of thinking, when we think in object orientation, we often make thinking mistakes, like habitually adding getters and setters. That's actually a thinking mistake, which we've ingrained, and it needs to be changed. We have a lot of baggage from procedural programming that's moved into object orientation. Switch statements, if statements, these things need to be changed. And as I said, what I said in my talk on Wednesday is that the more you learn about design patterns, the more interesting the differences become between them. And so as you study them, you'll notice the differences between different patterns that you wouldn't notice if you just occasionally use them. Okay, so here's the problem. We have a problem. Projects running sort of okay. Customers are reasonably happy, but the lead developer has left. He might have left even permanently. And these things do happen. People die. There's one company that where the main developer died, and the software process was really a mess. So it was a contract, and they didn't have his source code. He put it somewhere, and they didn't. So they had to decompile his classes in order to get the source code back, which was really ridiculous. So he's left. He's gone to another place, and the software works most of the time. But there are sometimes things which don't work correctly. So they call you in. And they say, Cedric, please come in and fix this code and add a few features. And the question is, how do you start? Where do you start looking? What do you do? And one of the problems that I've seen in working on code that other people have written and which has not been done properly is that sometimes you have entire blocks of code and classes which never ever get used. They never get run. It's, you know, if you don't get bug reports for your code from the customers, it's a good chance that they don't run it. So just make sure that you're actually being run. We had another company I worked for, they made hardware for a telecoms company, and they sold 1,000 units to this telecoms company, and they never got a single bug back. They never switched the machines on. They bought them and they left them standing there. So make sure that the code that you're working on is actually production code, is actually being used. There are stories of entire teams that are dedicated to working on dead code for years. Now, another question that I ask is, where are your unit tests? And this is one which often makes people a bit uncomfortable. How many of you are working in a company which has got a complete set of reliable unit tests? Let's see. Let me put my hand down. One person at the back. We have now got infinitely more than in Las Vegas. Okay. So this is something which very often you don't have. You should have it, but you don't have it. Very often you don't have it. This is one of the criticisms of Ruby developers against Java developers, is that the Java developers think their code works, but just because it compiles doesn't mean it works. Another question that I ask is, if I look at some code, where could I improve encapsulation? Where could I make access control tighter? Then another very embarrassing question is, what portion of code is commented? And we had an interesting discussion at TSS a few months ago about that. About how much do you comment, what do you comment, and so on. And then another thing that you have is, how can I find bad code? How can I measure the quality of code to pick out the part which is bad in order to improve that and to find the problems? Another thing which is difficult to find is copy and paste code. What I would love to see in an IDE is the eliminate copy and paste code button, where I click it and it goes through the entire project and it just, you know, moves things around and fixes all the copy and paste code. But that's not going to happen very soon. So my initial investigation is just to look at what am I working with. Where are comments missing? Where are they? And the way I like to work is every element should be documented. Whether it's a private element or a public protected, it doesn't matter. If it's an element, it should have a comment that explains why it's there. And also, it doesn't have to say too much about what it's doing, but it has to say why it's there. And it's more about the why than the what. So I've written a small docket. There are lots of other tools available for finding these things. But I wrote this a long time ago, a docket which finds all the places where you have undocumented elements. And an element would be a parameter, a field, a method, a constructor, which is not documented. You then go and I find fields that are not private. And in my opinion, it should not be allowed to have fields. You should not be allowed to have fields which are non-private. And if you look at the previous version of Java, Oak, if you look at Oak, which was a precursor of Java, they actually, the package access control was actually their version of private. But in Java 1, they introduced the private keyword. They didn't have that in Oak. But I don't think fields should ever be non-private, except if they are constant, final, static fields. Like, you know, then of course you have a different situation. So I look for broke encapsulation. I do simple metrics, like how many lines are we talking about per class, just to get some idea of what I'm looking at. There's one customer I had who had a class of 10,000 lines, and I mentioned this to another customer, and they said, well, we've got one which is 30,000 lines long, one class. Then another thing which I do is if a company's got unit tests, then I try and run a code coverage tool against the unit tests. So I run the unit test inside the code coverage tool, and I have a look at what code is not being executed, which then gives me some idea of what is not being tested properly or what is dead. All right, some ideas of values. Different projects, of course, I can't tell you the names. There was one project in South Africa with about 1,400 classes. And if I just looked at the lines of code, we had 264,000, which is not that much. The size of the classes were not that large, about 200 lines, but the standard deviation was fairly large. So, in other words, they had lots of small classes and some large classes. And if you look at the uncommented elements, we had 18 per class. So basically, one every 10 lines, on average, is uncommented. And this is not even talking about the comments inside your methods, if you need those. This is just talking about uncommented elements. Another project in Germany that I worked on was a very small project, just 62,000 lines, again, they had quite a large number of uncommented elements. Ideally, what you want to have is you want to have lots of small classes rather than having a few very large classes. And there are very many good reasons for that. It goes from garbage collection to being able to change the code better, being able to reuse code better when it's small classes rather than a couple of very large classes. If you see a lot of large classes, you will probably find also a lot of copy and paste code. So that's why my average I've put here is 80 with a standard deviation of 61, just to give some sort of, that's what I would aim for. And uncommented elements should be zero, but I've allowed one per class. Now, lines of code is a very, very rough measurement. But I'll get back to some better metrics that you can use. So what the comments should tell you is it should tell you the why. You don't want to have a comment that says method getName returns the name. Something like that is just a waste of time. I normally switch off the automatic comment generation because it then encourages me to actually write something of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And if I leave out the comments altogether, it also then helps me to find the places which still need to be commented. Sometimes what happens is I've written a long comment and I change the method. You always have to remember to change a comment as well if you change what you're doing. Now, this doesn't mean that the names and the parameters shouldn't be descriptive. Of course, they should be descriptive as well. So your names and your parameters should always be explaining what's actually happening in the class. In addition to the comments which explain why you're doing it. Now, I wrote a newsletter a long time ago which a lot of people misunderstood, and that was entitled, Why I Don't Read Your Code Comments. And it didn't say that I don't believe in comments. It just said that most of the time when I look at a project, the comments that are there are insufficient. And so I try to write them, but I don't always read them. I very seldom find projects with well-written comments. Now, let's have a look at the JDK, seeing that we are working with Java, and so we might as well have a look inside the Java development kit for some comment examples. Here's a class called javaawtColor.ColorSpace, and there's a method inside there in the JDK 1.3 called getName with int IDX, which I would imagine is index, with a name like that. I don't know why they didn't put the N and the E in there, but it doesn't really matter. So getName given an index, and it returns a new string, unnamed color component plus index. Now, when I look at that, I've got no idea what it actually is supposed to be doing. It says return the name of the component given the component index, but I'm still completely clueless as to what it's actually supposed to be doing and what I can expect as a user of this. In addition, there's a comment inside that says, remind, handle common cases here. Don't you love those to-dos that are everywhere in your code? They never get done. They're just there as to-dos. So look at the remind. Now, I don't know whether the remind is speaking to me as a user or the maintainer or who it speaks to. I presume it's to the maintainer because it's a comment inside the method. So look at Java 1.4. Java 1.4, they added more comments. They now said that IDX means the component index, which we assumed, but I still don't know what it actually, where it fits in. They've also added another element, the at return, which says again nothing, actually says nothing. And the reminder is still there. So this tells me that someone, some developer, went to the trouble of looking at that method. But he hasn't done anything about the remind. 1.5. It goes further. 1.5, they've now said that if index is less than 0 or index is less than component, number components minus 1, we're going to throw an illegal argument exception. The reminder is still there. Just remind yourself that handle common cases here. And there's probably a big question mark in, with all the developers at Sun. They don't know what that's supposed to be, probably, I would imagine. Because I've got no idea what it is either. So, and of course they've changed the comment. So somebody's touched it again in Java 1.4, and they still haven't touched the remind. Sorry, in 1.5. And when I was preparing for this talk, I decided to have a look at Java 6, which now, the method's become very long. It goes much further than that. They've now got a whole thing of switches and if statements and string arrays and whatever. I still don't have a clue what the method's actually doing. It's just become more confusing, and the reminders are, of course, still there. So this is actually an anti-example of how to code. But I actually like the fact that Sun gives us a source code because it allows us to find stuff like that and to... you know, this type of stuff is also happening in Microsoft's code, but you just can't see it. So then there's another habit that I've seen some people do. And some people do this because their company says they have to do it. And that is, you never delete a line of code. That some people do this. Now, we all use source control systems. It's just, we all do. There's nobody here. I cannot imagine one person here who would not use a source control system, even if it's CVS or SVC, whatever. But we're all using something. And the job of that is to keep track of your changes so that you can roll back and see what you had before if you need to. That's the job. So why comment out code? The only person who benefits from the code is the person who comments it out, and that for about 2 or 3 days, until he forgets why he commented it out. But there are companies, one company in South Africa that I know, where they have a company policy that you may not delete any code. You have to comment it out. So it just gets longer and longer and longer. There's a bunch of comments which are useless and which no one knows what they're doing. So don't duplicate the work done by the source control. If the code is dead, delete it. Don't comment it out. Okay, some funny comments. This one I found in Java 1.3. And they fixed this one in Java 1.4. I want you to look at this very carefully. It's on the slide so that we printed out, so you should be able to read it. Just have a look at that. You've got there we've got a private final static class array, null args. And this one, the way to initialize OIS args and OOS args would be to simply say static final class OIS args equals curly brace object input stream dot class curly brace. But they had this really weird construct where the first time it was used was like lazy initialization. The first time they used it, they would initialize it with this code, with the init static method args. And I didn't understand that until I looked a bit more closely at the object input stream. And you notice there's a typo there. It's supposed to be object input stream. And they wrote object input stream. And there was a comment that says, workaround compiler bug with the following code. Right? So, yeah, of course there's a compiler bug. There's no such class as object input stream. Now, I don't know for sure that this was what the compiler bug was, but I've got a strong suspicion that some developer was working on this stupid object stream class late at night on a Saturday, and the compiler team had gone home already, and he was saying, no, the compiler team are writing useless code again. Let's just write a workaround for this compiler bug. Here's another lovely comment in the JDK 1.4. If you look at Java AWT Toolkit, there's a method called enabled on toolkit with a method and with a comment, wonderfully disgusting hack for Solaris 9. They've taken that out in Java 5 as well. Now, if I see code that says hack inside there, a comment, it doesn't really worry me too much because at least I know the company, the programmer, is a real programmer. He admits that he writes hacks, and he knows he's writing a hack. So it's not such a problem. Now, one of the things that we have with writing code, with changing code, is that touching and changing any code is dangerous. It's almost always dangerous. Refactoring is dangerous. And I think what Cedric said earlier on was very good, is that this refactoring is becoming, the actual gain you get from it is becoming less and less because the refactorings are becoming more obscure. And the more obscure they become, the more dangerous they often become. I've several times already seen people do a refactoring, something like inlining a method name, inlining a variable, and by doing that, causing problems, causing mistakes. So this again says you have to have good unit tests. If you don't have good unit tests, then you have to be very lucky, or you have to just check everything you're doing. You also have to have system tests. Unit tests doesn't always pick up all the problems you do. Sometimes you need to have system tests. Something that I have found, though, with unit tests is that when I'm doing refactoring, sometimes the unit test can slow me down. As much as I need a unit test, it can still slow me down because it has actually bound me into a certain frame. And this is what the code does. If I want to change things around, it can make things more difficult. Now, if a project was a perfect, easy-to-work-on project, they wouldn't typically call me in. It's normally when there's a problem that they call me in. So the projects I see normally don't have unit tests. And if you look around the room, there was one person who's got good unit tests in the company. So that's another problem. Now, There was one project that I got called in a few years ago, 2 years ago, where they had a good programmer. Well, he was good, but he wasn't very disciplined, an undisciplined good programmer, who wrote a piece of code which worked, which was working in production, which sometimes failed. I had to go and fix some things, and I had to extend it and change a few things, add new functionality. So the customer was very kind to allow us to see the code, but I've changed the domain names and so on. And this is not the worst code I've had to work with. I've seen some much, much worse code than this. And if you look at the code, it's a really small project. We'll call it someone.com. And their single program is left. And so, as I said, it's a small project, 20,000 lines. And you would imagine this to take, you know, 5 minutes for any programmer to scan through and understand everything. If you look at the number of classes, it's 100 classes. They're a little bit too large, but it's not ridiculous. It's not like an average of 1,000. It's an average of 200. But you can see also from uncommented elements that there are virtually no comments at all. I spent about an hour with the programmer before I took over the project, and all he could say to me is, "Don't take on this project." That's all he said to me. "Whatever you do, don't do it. Get someone else." Now that worries me. What I did subsequently is I ran a couple of metrics over the code as well, because simply looking at lines of code can be deceptive. I mentioned on Wednesday that we managed to replace 600,000 statements with one dynamic proxy in one project, of which would be less than 100 statements. Now, the lines of code of that was about 100,000. So 100,000 was 600,000 statements. And it can go, of course, the other way as well. So the lines of code is an inaccurate measurement, a very inaccurate measurement. But it gives you a very rough indication, though. There are better metrics that you can use. Now, there are hundreds of metrics, but I don't want to apply hundreds of metrics because then I don't know what to look for. So I look for these things. Fan out. And what fan out tells you, it tells you that within a class, how many other classes are used in my fields, my parameters, and local variables, and returns, and in throws. And so from my class, how many other classes are being used? It's called fan out. It doesn't look at super types, doesn't look at primitives, and they say that the maximum should be 15 for this one. Now, there's a warning sign that I look at in code if I don't have a tool for this, and that is a very large number of import statements. If I look at a class and there's a large number of import statements, I know there's a problem already. You don't have to, it's already confirmed. And have a look at your code. Go through the code when you get back to your team. Have a look for classes with large import statements that will probably, in all probability, also have a very high fan out. Another useful one is Halstead program length, HP length. And this one is a Halstead software science metric. What they do is they count the number of operators plus the number of operands. And this, again, gives you much better indication than lines of code. Maximum should be 2,000, but the average should be much less than that. And another one which is quite useful is the maximum size of operation. This, again, counts I'm not quite sure how it's calculated, but it's looking at the cyclomatic complexity of the method, not of the class, of the method, and it looks at the number of if statements, the for statements, the while statements, in order to see how complicated it is. If you with the maximum size of operation, you can find methods which are badly factored, which need to be refactored. And then the last one that I want to mention is the number of added methods. This means that I've got a class and it's got a whole lot of methods that have been added to it. It would be extending another class, probably, and I've got a lot of other methods which have been added. Now, if I've got a class and the subclass has got a lot of new methods which are not defined in the superclass, that gives me an indication that the superclass is too different to the subclass, and that you should break up the whole hierarchy of it, change things around. So if you look at that inside this particular project, this is a graph that shows you I generated this with Together Control Center. You can see the fan out is out of the range, or there are some classes with a fan out which are out of range, and the maximum cells of operation, there are some classes which are out of range for that. The number of added methods in this case was okay. So this then allows me to zoom into the classes which have got the problem and address them first, sort them out first, if I can. Sometimes the code is so bad and so complicated you can't do much about it. All right. So the next step is to look at encapsulation. And encapsulation is a concept which I'm not sure if everybody understands it in the same way. The way I understand it is that the state of the object is hidden inside the object. I think that's a pretty standard definition. Now, the moment I write a getter and setter, like with my flower, I've now expose my internal state to the outside world. And very often when we code, because this has become such a common thing to do, we just code the getters and setters instead of writing the functionality into the class. And that's where we often go wrong with our designs. We end up with designs which are data-driven rather than function-driven. And right, so a few months ago I went and wrote the Sun Certified Java Associate exam. So I'm a Sun Certified Java Associate, which doesn't mean very much because it's actually the absolute easiest exam that you can write in Java. But I just wanted to see what is in the exam. And their definition of encapsulation in the exam was also not quite correct. If you think about it, there's not much difference between having a public field and having a public get and set method for that. And it's a fundamental problem that I've seen very many times, which leads to bad designs. Because then what happens is you're moving the functionality out of the class into the client class that's now calling getNAM and doing something with it. I remember when I first heard about entity beans. Now, the people that developed entity beans, the first version of entity beans, are not stupid. If you look at how the entity beans were used, then we would think that they were stupid, but they weren't stupid. It's just that they were thinking of something which nobody could find a use case for. It's being very, how should we say, kind to, generous to them. And the problem here was that the original idea of an entity bean, when I heard it about 6 years ago, was it's like a session bean, but it's persistent. So that was the original idea. It's like a session bean, but it's persistent. And whereas when people started using it, they said, oh, great, it's a database layer. Which wasn't the original idea. I still don't know what the use case is of it, but anyway. Okay, so if you want to find non-private fields in order to eliminate them, you can do that again with my doclet, with another doclet that I wrote, or there are lots of other tools that will do this for you. I'll list them at the end. And it's, what my doclet does is it spits out a whole lot of fields which are non-private, either protected or public or package access. And in this particular case, I found about 200 non-private, non-constant fields which I could look at and see why are they not private. Very often, they're not private because the programmer was sloppy. Other times, they're not private because there's a fundamental design problem inside the code. So there are different ways you can fix this. The approach that I normally used in the past was to make them private, try and compile, see what breaks. It's not a very satisfying approach, and it kind of wastes a lot of time. There are other other ways to do it a bit more automatically. And this is what actually made me buy IntelliJ. I still don't know about IntelliJ because I think it's actually costing me money using it. Because I'm a contractor, I work and I get paid per hour. So I have to pay for the tool and it's making me faster. So it's actually wasting money, right? Anyway, but it's fun to use. So here we've got the class that I was talking about, or the system I was talking about. And if we do an analysis over the system, we can very easily find all the places where there are non-private fields which could be private. So this gets rid of sloppiness, where the coder could have made it private, but he decided for whatever reason that he didn't feel like doing it. So here we go to analysis, inspect code, and I look for non-private, and off you go. It's running around looking at the code. Now, unfortunately, this version of IntelliJ has got a bug in that it doesn't persist some of the settings. So I can't show you all of the things that it can do. But here, for example, you see I actually only want to find the non-private fields, but it's also showing me the methods, but it's not really a problem. Here, protected int index. Now, a protected int index is not being referenced from anywhere except from the limited file data source, from nowhere else. So what I can do is I can say accept stress at access level, which makes it private. So it's made it private now. And in fact, if I want to be lazy, I could just go and say accept it for all of them, and it's made all the code, taken away the private, made those fields and methods private, which can be made private without affecting anything. Of course, in order to do that, you have to, especially with methods, methods are a bit dangerous because with methods, there might be some other class which is using your class. With fields, they shouldn't touch your fields in the first place. So you have to have a complete tree, code tree, in order to do this. Okay, it's a bit of an anticlimax because it works so quickly. But when you rerun the docklet, you now find that from the 203 non-private fields, you've now gone down to 104 non-private fields. So the whole code becomes already easier to work with because you don't have this global state that's being changed from all over the place. But now the question is, why do I have 104 non-private fields? There's also still a problem. And I'm in this case, I'm not counting the constant fields. And that's the real work. This is when you actually have to start thinking. Another thing which I try and do wherever possible is I try to make my fields final, immutable, wherever possible. And there are various reasons for that. If you create an object and throw it away again, it doesn't take very much effort on the CPU for the VM. It takes a lot of effort if you create an object and hold onto it for a long time. There's a very big difference between. But if you create an object and throw it away again, the garbage collector is optimized for that. What's interesting about the garbage collector is that the garbage collector takes more effort if you have a lot of objects which remain in the memory than to remove them. To actually do the garbage collection is very fast. But if there are a lot of objects that it has to check, then it starts getting slow. And you get these long pauses while it's working. So, immutable objects, easier to work with. You can find bugs more easily. I'll show you why. And your synchronization is also easier. Now, let's say, for example, I've got a class with very descriptive long names. This is written by someone who doesn't like comments, so he just writes the comment into the class name. And he calls it session connector with retry at least 3 times. And you've got connection name received from internet and int number of times that we should try at least. Right? So we add a constructor, and we have a constructor that takes a C and an N. Now, of course, when you see code like that, you're wondering what does the C mean and what does the N mean, so you have to add a java.doc comment for that. Ideally, what you want to do is you want to have the parameter, the same name as the field that's become the convention in Java, whether you like that approach or not. That has most companies do that. So if I'm calling this class, I have to first read the comments in order to know what the C and the N are. So it's better to from the start write in the name. But of course now it's getting really long now. So this now guy is typing with VI and or Notepad or something, and he's typing in the fields and the parameters, and then you've got connection number received from internet, and he assigns it. And he wonders why his field is always null. Can you see why the field is always null? Right? There's a wonderful mistake. Instead of writing a C, I typed an O. And so, because, and what happens then is that when I say this dot connection name received from internet equals connection name received from internet, I'm actually saying the field equals the field. The field is null, so it equals null. The parameter is never used. So if you make it final, then you immediately see that there's a problem. You immediately see that you never assigned it. So I try to make fields as private and final as possible. By adding encapsulation to existing code, I'm not really doing anything which is dangerous, as long as I've got all the use cases off the code. And I'm improving the ease with which I can change things without breaking other parts. Now, there are different ways you can find the non-final fields. Again, I just wrote a doclet. You can take the private doclet and modify it to look for final. It's very easy. And again, you could take to fix it, either change them by hand and see what breaks. This is a bit easier because you're only looking within a class. Or go with something like IntelliJ, which goes and does it automatically when they don't add bugs into IntelliJ that don't do it properly. Okay, so how final is final? And this is something which surprised me. If you look at Java 1.1, the access control, private and so on, was not checked at runtime. So you could write a class that had the same interface as another class, but make the fields public, compile your class against that class, and then run your class against the real class and access the private fields. And it wouldn't get picked up at runtime. You could do that without any restrictions. Which, of course, was not a very good idea. They fixed that in 1.2. They made access control checked at runtime. And you could override that check with saying set accessible true, which was then also checked by the security manager to make sure that you had the permission to do that. In Java 1.1, you could not rebind final fields at runtime with reflection. What they then did in 1.2 is they changed their mind. They decided to make it so that you can rebind final fields at runtime with reflection, 1.2. 1.3, they then decided that you can't rebind them at runtime. And 1.5 and 1.6, you can rebind them at runtime. So basically, when you make a field final, it doesn't mean necessarily that it's going to be final for the rest of the virtual machine, for the rest of the application running. It is possible now with reflection to change it. I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to change it. In fact, I think it's a bad idea to change it. But it is possible to change it. The only time when you can't change it is when the final field is a primitive and or a string which are set at declaration time. Then you can't change it because it gets inlined at compile time. But other than that, you can change it. How are we doing for time? So, and if you look at this in the context of time, here's just a timeline of the Java versions. You had about 15 months, Java 1.1, 18 months, Java 1.2, then 51 months. So it's basically about 4 years of it being final, now it's not final anymore. Basically, I would suggest you just treat it as final, because otherwise you can run into problems later on one day. Okay, dead code. As I said already, I have several times spent too much effort fixing bugs in dead code, which is really, really, really irritating. So what I try and do is I make the elements as private as possible, make the fields final, then I search for dead code and delete it. And of course, all my code is in source control. So if I delete too much, I'll just do rollback to the previous version. So if you do that, I've managed to reduce the lines of code. I've managed to reduce the non-private fields, the non-final fields. The whole code becomes easier, more malleable, easier to work with. Also, what I do is, in order to not get confused, I normally delete commented out code. It's in the source control anyway, so I'm not throwing it away forever. I'm just going to delete it because it's the root problem of commenting out code is that you're too scared to throw away your efforts. That we are too scared. I'm too scared to throw away what I've done. Even though I know it's in source control, I'm just scared that I'm going to need it. But most of the time, you never need it again. And if you do need it, you can go and get it from source control. So now it's easier to work with the system because I don't get confused by that. Something else which I saw recently was the whole thing of the depth of inheritance hierarchy. And Cameron Purdy actually held the record for a short while until someone replaced him for the record of the deepest hierarchy. But see, there's somebody else who's worse. And quite often what you find is if you've got an inheritance hierarchy which is either too deep or too wide, that you haven't used abstraction properly. And you should avoid using too deep hierarchies. What you can do is if you want to look for hierarchies, I've got a little tool in my newsletter where you can give it a jar file and it will go and find the deepest hierarchy that is available inside there. What you'll find, though, is that GUI classes, if you're using Swing or something like that, your GUI classes typically have got a very deep hierarchy. There's not that much you can do about that. A few words about exception handling. We talked about this yesterday at our Rife discussion, briefly. Often when I look at bad code, it also has bad exception handling. And it's something which you need to look at in order to avoid having surprises and having problems disappear. Now, this code that I was working on worked quite well at the customer, but only because the customer never saw that there were problems. It just didn't really work anymore. He just thought it was working. So I normally do a quick manual inspection for bad exception handling, just to get some idea of people doing things like this. Init GUI throws exception. You should never throw exception from a method. Catch blocks which are empty. And there are, again, lots of tools you can use to do this for you, to find these for you. I've seen people catch runtime exception. This is actual code. Date equals fruit spec table model. Catch runtime exception. Now, this catches any runtime exception that could happen. And you should never catch a runtime exception. Runtime exceptions tell you that there's a problem in the runtime. Now, this is actually one of the problems with the whole definition of runtime exception, is that runtime exception was originally meant to be an exception which is caused by the runtime. In other words, if I'm going past the end of an array, then the runtime will protect itself against you. And who's the runtime? The runtime is a virtual machine. So it's actually an exception which is caused by the virtual machine to protect it against you. Null pointer exception. It's a runtime exception. And what happened with Java is that the whole thing the whole concept was mixed up through the addition of checked exceptions. So this is a very dangerous thing, to catch runtime exception like this and to do something, catch it. You should rather check the value of I before you try and catch a runtime exception. Also, if I'm catching exception itself, that's also really bad. I should first catch runtime exception and rethrow it. So what happens if I've got bad exception handling? Well, part of the system could stop working. The user might think it's still working, but it's not. So anything that goes wrong, you need to log this properly. And since Java 5, we've got a global exception handler, which helps. Which helps to give you one place where you can handle all exceptions. You can also specify it for each thread, an exception handler. You can have a look at the code. I've got a code sample here which puts it into Swing. So you just say default uncaught exception handler. The problem, of course, is that it's a static method. So if your application server has already called it and you call it again, you're going to overwrite it. So now the fun starts, because now the question is, how do I find duplicate code? This is not so easy. Why are the fields non-private? You also have to spend some effort to set up a test environment in order to make sure that the code still works correctly. And I wrote some Java J2ME code at one of the projects, and we had to use. I wrote some unit tests, but they had to be very limited. And they couldn't obviously run the unit tests on the phone as well. So you have to make sure that you've got all unit testing, some type of test environment. But from there onwards, you have to tread very carefully, because if you make a mistake, you have to be able to roll back easily and check that the code still works. Okay, one word about reflection and dynamic proxies. My talk about dynamic proxies. The moment you use dynamic proxies, you can't use the static tools anymore, like IntelliJ that finds all the dead code. You can't remove dead code if you've got dynamic proxies, because you don't know through a static analysis what isn't being used dynamically anymore. So be careful of that. Now, I use these principles when I code in order to check myself and to make sure that I'm actually coding properly for the next person. So whenever you write your own code, make sure that you've got your elements which are properly documented, exceptions handled properly, your fields are private, final, you've got unit tests, and have a look always for copy and paste code and eliminate that. Copy and paste code is really, really dangerous, because you write one bug, now you've got the bug in five different places because you've copied and pasted. In addition, when you're doing a profiling and you're running the profiler, you see one piece of code which is at number 5, but there are actually 5 pieces of code which are doing the same thing. So actually attribute number 1, but because you've copied and pasted, it's gone down to number 5. So, develop with pleasure. Make your code a pleasure to work with, and don't be scared of fixing messy code. Now what I did was I printed out at the end of this a whole bunch of keystroke hints, which are not really part of the talk, but just as an appendix. You've got, I'm not sure if it's printed on there, but it's on the, it should be on the website. How to do all the different keystrokes in Eclipse, how to do them in IntelliJ, and then also some style and metrics tools that you can use. Unfortunately, I haven't found to date an open source free metric tool that will find that will calculate the Halstead metrics, but there are other ones which can check your style for you. Any questions? We've got, I think, about 5 minutes to ask any questions. Yes.
I just want to ask you about the point you made on getters and setters not being true encapsulation. What happens in sort of some cases, because of Java's lack of fine-grained access modifiers, you are forced to do it, for example, with entity classes. your persistence framework could be in a different package and your UI framework could be in a different package.
Right.
So just for getting and setting those values and displaying back to the client, you're forced to add setters and getters because even though they're not part of natural interface for the class.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. And this is the problem. What happens is we end up having to do them because we're forced by the frameworks to do them. But it's not from object orientation. You've now got a data object, and you've got the function object which is supposed to work on the data. And this is supposed to be one thing in object orientation. It's supposed to be one class with the data, which is encapsulated, and the function is working on it. Mm. So the whole concept of a data transfer of a POJO, which is only getters and setters, isn't really that good in terms of object orientation because you've separated the behavior from the data.
Sure.
But it's what we have to deal with.
Another question I want to ask was it's something similar to the fan-out metrics you mentioned.
Yeah.
But there's something else that's often mentioned called law of Demeter in terms of maintainability of code, like it's what method on what objects you can call into.
Yeah. I was wondering whether to include that. I don't use that often, although I probably should. There was one case where I had, I wish I could show you the code, but I think I deleted it, where there was, now the law of Demeter, if I remember correctly, is something like this, that you've got a.getName.toUppercase.blah.somethingelse.somethingelse.
Yeah.
That type of code you want to eliminate, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I haven't seen that to be a problem that often. Although the last project with the 2.5 million lines, they had that quite a lot. But yeah, that's definitely a smell which one needs to look for.
Okay, thank you.
Pleasure.
Yes.
Where's the voice coming from?
Ah, over there. Here, yeah.
Excellent.
Hi. It's related to the questions of getters and setters in a way, I think, but it's about the final fields. Now, presumably, if you're using some kind of ORM tool like Hibernate or TopLink,
right.
That will need to set your fields
sure.
when it gets objects
sure.
back from the database.
Absolutely.
And now, then you couldn't make your fields final, at
correct.
Least not in 1.4. So is there a way to reconcile this?
It's a bit difficult. I tried to do that when I was using JDO in 1.5. Because with the version of JDO I was using, I think you could actually set the final fields. Yeah, you could. With 1.5 you can, yeah.
So would you recommend that?
No, I can't recommend that because the problem with final is that there's actually a conflict between the dynamic behavior and the compilation behavior.
Yep.
The moment you say it's final, I have to set it, and it has to be checked at compile time that it gets set. I can't leave it blank. So let's say, for example, I have a string which I say string equals null. Now, the moment I say string equals null, that value of the string will be inlined everywhere where it's being called from. So that won't work. I've tried doing that. You can't do it. The moment you have getters and the moment you have setters, you can't use final anymore. It's more for your behavioral code than for the data code, the data access code.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Any other questions? No more questions? Good. Then I think we're on time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have any other comments and like to chat and say hello, please come up. Thank you very much.